This is a previously recorded episode.
Welcome to M Squared TechCast, a live internet radio show offering the latest news and interviews with the people driving business, technology, and politics in Michigan. Now, your hosts, Matt Rausch and Mike Brennan.
Hey, it's Matt Rausch.
And Mike Brennan.
Welcome to yet another fun-filled edition of the M Squared TechCast, proudly part of the PodcastDetroit.com network.
Indeed, and we got a good show for you today, starting off with Ken Rogers, who we're very sad about this. Ken announced that he's retiring from Automation Alley on August 26th. He's going to talk about that. We also have on the show in the second segment Patrick Anderson. Patrick does all these great surveys that you see all over the place, and he's actually shopping around for a new CEO or COO for one of his companies called Supported Intelligence.
Yeah, so just imagine the bow tie in your head when we're talking to him.
Yeah, that's Patrick.
That's his signature.
Yes. Even his son. His son wears a bow tie, too. I met him. So we have Enrico Schaefer in the third segment, and he's going to be talking about all these new regs that came out last week by the FAA for commercial drone operators.
Very, very timely. Yes,
yes. Very timely.
You're seeing a lot more drones around this summer than I've ever seen before.
So, yeah. And then finally, Dale Kuypert, CEO of 360 Interactive. Say hi, Dale.
Hello, everybody.
And he's going to be joining us in the fourth segment. Or if he wants to weigh in on any of these other segments, he's welcome to do so. So we'll start with Ken. So, Ken.
Welcome.
Yes.
Well, thanks very much for having me, guys.
17 years ago, you and Brooks Patterson started Automation Alley back in 1999, probably like it's 1999, right? So,
And tell us what you were doing at that point when Brooks approached you.
I was, Deputy County Executive for Oakland County Government, and he walked in my door one day and said, "You know anything about Automation Alley?" And I said, I know it's some sort of a business group." He said, "Well, the planning isn't going the way I want it to go, and I want you to step in and pick it up and try to make it go. I want it to work." And that's how I got involved in Automation Alley.
Wow. So back then, I mean, the driving force was we just weren't finding enough talent for the tech companies in Southeast Michigan. That was one of the reasons, I know, right?
It sure was, Mike. The business community had come to Brooks and in 98, and they were concerned about the availability of technology talent in the region. And they said, "If we don't have the talent, we can't stay." Hmm. Well, that caused us to look around, hire some research done, and the bottom line is that after the research, it became obvious that we had a technology center here in Southeast Michigan that nobody really had identified. So we decided to put a face on it and call it Automation Alley.
So do you have any idea what the inspiration for the name was?
Yes, it actually came from Brooks, and I'm not quite sure where he derived it from, but there was a lot of questioning about the name, Automation Alley, and at the time, of course, the fit now is perfect, but we looked at Silicon Valley, and what did that stand for? What did Route 128 in Boston stand for? The Research Triangle Park in the Carolinas? And we stepped back and said, you know, what really happens is it matters the value you bring to the name. And so we went with Automation Alley and decided to bring the value we wanted to it.
All right. So looking back over those 17 years, what would be some of your proudest accomplishments with Automation Alley?
Well, nearly 6,300 jobs have been created in this region. Hmm. And more than a half a billion in export sales have resulted from our trade missions and our export activities. That's a big number. We're on our way to $1 billion in export sales through the next 5-6 years. I mean, that's just a huge, huge statement for our companies in this region who are the beneficiaries of those dollars. We've invested over $9 million in tech startups, and 17 high-tech companies have been attracted to Southeast Michigan. So the results are there. It's the ROI, I think, that has made the Alley grow from 42 members in 99 to just under 1,000 today.
It is amazing. So where do you see your organization going, say, over the next decade or so?
Well, I think we're dedicated to building Automation Alley as the number one technology organization in the country, and I can say that comfortably. We're the youngest amongst the technology centers in the country, and we stand now in those 15 centers about right in the middle, and we've done that in only 17 years. So I think we can make a run at it. And the Alley is committed to helping local manufacturers transition into that new area, a new era of technology-based manufacturing, which we want to call Industry 4.0, which incorporates automated manufacturing, the Internet of Things, and big data. So we think we can lead the nation in that transition. And, you know, after all, you look at Southeast Michigan, you want to make something in the United States, you make it here. We can make anything. And we have the technical expertise that can make that happen. So we're excited about the future and the organization's role in branding Southeast Michigan as the Center for Technology.
Well, that's one of the things I thought was really interesting that you've done over the years. There are these annual technology industry reports. And those, I think, were prompted by an electronics industry trade association that sort of didn't give us credit for being as high-tech as we were. The way I remember you and other people describing it is they would count a janitor at Microsoft as a high-tech employee and a computer programmer for Ford as a Rust Belt employee. So talk about that a little bit, about how those reports sort of started coming out and started showing, you know, the real high-tech muscle of this region.
Well, you know, it was an agitating kind of a thing, aggravating, I should say, a kind of a thing, that the way they looked at the tech talent and identified it in this region, and that half the work here done in technology wasn't acknowledged as being a true technology work or job. And we had a fit over that and decided that we were going to make our case in a technology report of our own. So we began to issue a report on an annual basis. And, you know, we get this Silicon Valley myth, I want to call it. I mean, there's no question the Valley delivers technology in a huge way. But, you know, when it comes to San Jose, and you look at it, San Jose today, three out of four people in San Jose want to leave. And there's a reason for that. The cost of living's huge. Traffic is a mess. And they have little or no quality of life. They spend all their dollars for housing. You got a 1,200-square-foot house in San Jose, costs $650,000. That same house here, 1,200 square feet, is $165,000. So y'all down there in San Jose, you need to get in a car, grab a plane, and take a bus and get to Southeast Michigan.
Yeah, I have a friend of mine, Rachel Conrad, who's been working for the Alliance over in Paris, Renault-Nissan Alliance, and she's her 5 years is up, so she's taking a job in Silicon Valley, and she was telling me they bought a house, I can't remember which city it is in Silicon Valley, 1,200 square foot, $1.2 million. And that's amazing, isn't it?
Imagine, and these tech workers, I mean, you're talking about supposedly paradise out there. These tech workers, there are 5, 6, 7 of them, are renting a 1,000-1,200-square-foot house so they can split the rent so they can have some housing while they're out there. I don't think that says much about quality of life.
Yeah, absolutely.
And by the way, we don't have the forest fires and the earthquakes.
Well, not too much rain either.
Yeah, right? Well, I was going to say, other than the occasional ice storm in the winter, I think we're pretty well set against natural disasters. So Ken, tell us a little bit about what you personally plan on doing in the years to come after your formal retirement.
Well, I'm going to I had a music group in college, folk music, and I'm been looking at guitars, and I'm going to buy a new guitar and get back at playing my guitar, and I'm going to write a book and maybe a little music as well, and I need time for my family, my wife, and grandchildren, and I will continue to serve as chairman of the board for Clarkston State Bank. It's a bank on the grow, and I've been involved with it and invested with that bank when it started. And lastly, I'll be a consultant for Automation Alley for a period of time. So that's going to be the immediate things on the agenda.
So I'm seeing a goatee and a beret in your future. Is that right?
God help us all if that's what you see.
And the stripe, the vertical stripe, and the horizontal stripe shirt looking very French, you know? Oui. So.
Who knows?
All right, yeah, and hopefully there won't be a jalousy hanging off your lip. Okay.
So, true enough.
So what's it been like to lead this organization? I mean, you know, I'm going to give you a chance here to give credit to other people, I guess. Tell me about who's been instrumental in this thing, growing it to 1,000 members and really sort of making it the voice for Southeast Michigan's high tech economy.
Well, if you're going to talk about Automation Alley, you've got to start with the man whose idea it was, and that's Brooks Patterson. Brooks is an idea man, and he's very creative, and it was his concept that I was fortunate enough to have the opportunity to bring some life into it. I have to say that there were several people at the county. When I started out, we had no staff, we had no money. We were housed in a closet, and people on staff, Phil Bertolini and Nancy Scarlett and a couple others, were big help getting us going. But I really found that if you want to be successful, I've had four careers, and if you want to be successful, hire good people, empower them, let them do what you hired them to do. Give them the tools to succeed and support them. You do those things and step aside, you're usually going to be successful. And it's the staff here at Automation Alley over the years that's made Automation Alley the success that it is today.
Well, I remember a lot of the early staff have gone on to do much bigger things. Some of them started out as interns and have worked their way up to be vice presidents of companies. So it's been a good learning experience for them as well, right?
You know, I'm glad you mentioned that, Mike, because we've got one that's a vice president of a bank, another that's a vice president of a DMC, and another one of the downtown business group. Business Association is a senior officer there. So we've got people that have graduated from the alley that have found significant positions in Southeast Michigan. And those are the proud people I was talking about that helped build the alley, and the Charlie DeVries and Michelle Zellens and Beth Uttons and so on.
And those are the three. Kozlowski. Those are the four, actually, that I was thinking of. So,
yeah, they're really good. We've really had some talented people come through here. And as they say, if you empower them and get out of the way and let them do what you hired them to do, you're going to find success, and they take you there.
Let me. We got about a minute left. So, successors. I know you can't name names, but do you have a short list yet?
Board of directors at Automation Alley has a short list, and they're in the process of going through it. It'll be their call and not mine. We have a COO here, Tom Kelly, who's done a great job done everything I've asked him to do for the last year and a half.
Yeah, we would recommend him. He's been on the show three, four times now, Matt?
Yeah. Yeah, we've known him for quite a while, with doing other things in the area, but he's a real go-getter, that's for sure.
Yeah, so
he's a very talented guy. He's an electrical engineer. He's got a background in business. He's owned his own and sold it. He's got a long background in entrepreneurial-related activities, and he's good at it.
Hi. Oh. This is Patrick Anderson.
Oh, hang on, Patrick. We're still live. So
yeah, we're still live with Tom with Ken Rogers. So
Ken Rogers,
you can say hi to Ken Rogers if you like.
Hello, who is this? Pat Anderson.
Yeah, hang on, Patrick. All right, we're just wrapping up with Ken. So, Ken, well, 17 years, it ends in August. I'm hoping there's going to be a big party. I've already volunteered to be one of the MCs if you guys need me there for that. Matt will join us, I'm sure.
Oh, gosh, yes.
And so, congratulations, and we'll look forward to following what you're going to do after this.
But, thanks very much, guys, and I do want to thank you guys for the role you play in technology in Southeast Michigan for so long and a period of time, and we appreciate you very much. Thank you.
All right, and this is Mike Brennan.
And it's Matt Rausch. And you're listening to the M Squared TechCast, part of the PodcastDetroit.com network. We'll be right back.
Hey, it's Mike Brennan.
And it's Matt Rausch, and you're listening to the M Squared TechCast, part of the PodcastDetroit.com family. Go ahead, Mike.
And we have on the line Patrick Anderson calling in from East Lansing. And how you doing today, Patrick?
I'm doing all right. Nice to meet with you guys.
Patrick wears many hats. He's the chairman of the Anderson Economic Group. It's all these surveys that you see, somehow he seems to be involved in many of them. He also has a new company, relatively new company, that's called Supported Intelligence. And I'm going to let you explain the technology and methodology behind it since it's your baby. Now, it's been around for 3 years or so
now? Since 2012, that's right. Right here in Michigan, we have one of the most advanced artificial intelligence data analytics startup software companies, a Supported Intelligence LLC, headquartered in East Lansing, and the folks there using some things that I helped invent and some things that a lot of other people have invented as well, have some cutting-edge decision analytics tools that they use for a variety of things. They have been using them in different parts of the country, but it's still a very small, fledgling firm with a really, really new, innovative product that's starting to get some attention, and it's all right here since 2012.
Well, I know during the NCAA basketball tournament, you've had pretty good success with it, predicting what the brackets are going to look like. And I know in terms of traffic, when I post those stories, we're getting thousands of hits on them. So people are very interested in that.
Yeah, it's one of the amazing innovations. This is Support Intelligence came up with decision analytics here. So it's not just crunching numbers a little bit faster than other people. It actually gives people advice on things, and it's a whole new category of analytical tools that you're going to see a lot of, I think, in the future. And one of our really smart people came up with an actual application of that, which is to pick a better basketball bracket if you like to, you know, maybe for just fun and entertainment, get in an office pool on the March Madness NCAA basketball tournament. And it starts with the insight that you're not really playing basketball. What you're doing is you're playing your coworkers. So what you want to do is get a better bracket than they do. And amazingly, the decision analytics that we use that say someone might want to use to help improve their business also can help you figure out how to write down a better bracket than your coworkers just by answering a few questions. And we offered that online this year, and it did amazingly well.
Yeah. Cool. So is that something that can be used in digital marketing to predict performance in that area maybe?
I sure hope so. We have a whole set of applications that right now with just a handful of people working on, we haven't been able to get into commercialization yet. But these are the kind of things that you'd look at if you're trying to, say, make a business decision. You have four or five different opportunities. What's the best to increase the value of your company? And actually, what you're talking about in digital marketing, one of the most important decisions that people are making nowadays is what kind of promotional efforts they should do. And as you said, digital marketing. And there is an application that we've developed to help people pick what's the best way to spend their advertising dollars. Because, I mean, any business knows that spending a lot on social media, digital marketing, email, coupons, things like that, that a lot of that seems to be wasted. One of the decision tools that we've developed using this technology is one that actually helps you pick where do you actually get the value from your marketing campaign, as opposed to just one-time hits as is common. For example, with Groupon, it was part of the infatuation with Groupon that you were able to get a lot of new customers that were in the door for the first time, and many of them left. So now businesses have woken up and they realize that they want to focus on value. So they like new customers, but they like customers that would stay around. One of the applications of this technology is to help you pick your marketing plans that actually help you get and keep customers.
Well, I bring that up because we have in studio who's Dale Kuypert, who's the CEO of 360 Interactive. He does digital marketing, and he's going to be on one of our later segments. And I wanted to get his opinion. I know you don't really know the technology, but what do you think of what he's saying?
Oh, it's spot on. Anytime that we can start to get people to really look at their analytics and understand the connection between the dollar spent and the revenue earned, it just makes a smarter marketer. And that's one of the biggest challenges that we have right now in the marketplace is people are spending money. They don't know exactly what the return on investment is. And quite honestly, the information that they have is so raw in terms of numbers, it's hard for them to interpret what it really means.
Yeah, we'll have to get you two guys together. Maybe we can come up with a product that you can both push or something. So,
shifting gears completely, Patrick.
Yes,
we were talking before you, before we went on air, a little bit about Brexit, and I just wanted your opinion on sort of what it means for business in the Midwest, for specifically tech businesses in the Midwest. You know, what does it mean for the Automation Alleys of the world?
I'm very happy that you're asking about Automation Alley because I think Brexit is going to prove to be another benefit for Automation Alley, perhaps not the most intended one here, and I'm not saying anybody in Automation Alley had anything to do with it, but Automation Alley is now.
Well, Trump actually works with Automation Alley.
Yeah,
so,
yeah,
you know.
Boris has been working with him, too, in London, right.
But the Automation Alley now competes globally for tech talent and also in terms of being one of the internationally recognized tech hubs, and we've been happy at Anderson Economic Group to help document and measure that and compare them with the Silicon Valleys and the Austins of the world as well. Part of what happens with the decision by Britain to pull out of the EU over the next 2 years is that companies that want to enter a large market are now going to be somewhat reluctant to use, say, London or Northern Ireland as an entrance point into what is a very large market, the European Common Market. And when they start to look around and see places where you can get a lot of tech talent and you can export into a huge market, Automation Alley just looks better now. And it looks better compared to some of their worldwide competitors than it did last week, particularly if you're in Europe. So I think we're going to see, again, an unintended byproduct, but I think some of the companies that are using Britain or Northern Ireland as an entrance to the EU, we're going to be looking at pulling some of that tech talent back to the United States and look at places like Automation Alley. And in some cases, people that are deciding, do I enter the United States or do I enter the EU? They're going to be looking towards the United States as being, you know, a much more stable, very large market.
We hope. Yes. Hey, also, I know one of the things you mentioned you wanted to talk about was Tesla's foray into integrating with SolarCity. How do you see that playing out?
Well, that, I mean, is I think you're mentioning Forbes. Forbes magazine did a really nice little splash on the best way to fill out your bracket, and they picked Support Intelligence, the East Lansing company, for that. So the number one way to fill out your bracket is go to the Michigan company that invented how to do that. They also did an interesting story about the ongoing effort of Tesla to ask states to change their laws so that they can go in and sell without having a dealership.
Oh, right, yeah, going around the franchise laws, right, yeah.
Going around the franchise laws, and it turns out I actually testified in Virginia on exactly this case, on exactly this matter, because our company does a lot of work in this automobile space. And one of the things I was pointing out, and again, I was saying I can't believe that they have hired us to come all the way out there to say this, but, you know, Tesla is a car company. It's called Tesla Motors. They build cars, and the cars that need to have, what you know, windshield wipers and other things replaced, tires worn out, and you can't do that over the Internet. So you really need a dealership network. You can't talk about this being reinventing technology and somehow you're going to deliver, you know, windshield washer fluid through your Internet. Well, Tesla is still, I mean, they were on just a tear with Wall Street, and one of the things you saw with their talk about now integrating with an entirely new area of technology that I think is going to be there for power systems for homes and for whole grids is that I think Wall Street's finally looked at this and said, you guys have not only bitten off too much of this loaf, you've gone into the bakery next door and bitten off too much. I mean, it's just... You really see them, I think, causing a lot of people to wonder about their strategy and even a little bit about their sanity to go in such a strong direction outside of what they're trying to do. And so that's something that I think is going to be, for Tesla's sake, I hope they get back to focusing on something that they could be very good at, which is building, you know, luxury electric or partial electric cars. And rather than going off into thinking that tech reinvents everything and one tech company can literally change two sectors of the economy.
Pets.com.
Yes, 40-pound bags of dog food with free shipping. We've seen this before. All right, Patrick.
Yeah, I think we have.
Patrick Anderson, thank you very much for talking with us today. If people want more information on what you offer, it's Anderson Economic Group, and what's the website there?
AndersonEconomicGroup.com is where the consulting firm hangs out, and a lot of stuff there, and including some of the Automation Alley reports that we mentioned before about what a great thing. And then SupportIntelligence.com, which has some terrific technology, and as you mentioned earlier, actually, on Tech News points out, is actually looking for a new CEO now. So, interesting place.
All right. Thanks very much, Patrick Anderson. For right now, this is Matt Rausch.
And Mike Brennan.
And you're listening to the M Squared TechCast. We'll be right back in just a moment with a drone law expert, Enrico Schaefer. And we're back. It's Matt Rausch.
And Mike Brennan.
And you are listening to the M Squared TechCast, a proud part of the PodcastDetroit.com network. And listen to IT and the D every Monday night from 9 to 11. It's very entertaining.
Yeah, that would be... Those would be two good words to describe it. Very entertaining. I was trying to be, since there are, we love you, Dave and Bob, but you're a little wacky sometimes.
Oh,
you
yeah.
Know?
So, yeah. Well, that's, wacky's a good thing.
Yeah, wacky, yeah.
And not the least bit wacky is our
Enrique.
drone law expert, Enrico Schaefer from Traverse City. That lucky fellow gets to live up in God's country. But Enrico, we wanted to have you on today because, once again, your appearance is very timely.
Yeah, Matt, it's been a big week. On June 21st, the FAA announced the finalization of what is known as Part 107, which are the new drone regulations, which will become effective and implemented starting at the end of August. So we've, after years and years and years of waiting, we finally have regulations for UAV, unmanned aerial vehicles, that people can comply with, and most importantly, a drone pilot license, which people can go out and get for about $150.
That's cheap, actually, isn't it?
Hey, think about it this way. You go to the bar, you tell the people who want to listen that I'm a pilot, right? We all know that that's going to get you a long way. You don't have to throw in.
Ladies are going to really like that. You know, you got to have a white scarf on. You walk in, the ladies will go for that, right?
Every time.
I'm watching Jessica. I'm waiting to see if that right cross is going to come through the air here. So, but I'm good so far. So tell us a little bit more about the $150. This can't be too rigorous, then, right? I mean, what are they testing?
So there's a knowledge test that you have to pass in order to become a drone pilot that can fly under Part 107. They're calling it a remote pilot's license, or it's a variation of an airman's certificate, so it's like any other pilot license, but it's for UAV, for unmanned aerial vehicles. And so, yeah, you have to go take this knowledge test, which is essentially a test on airspace. You have to know what airspace you're flying in, if it's G, if it's D, if it's E airspace. You have different regulations that'll apply, so they're going to test you on that. But they're mostly going to test you on Part 107, which are the new regulations. When can you fly? Who can fly? What are the regulations that apply to your drone operation? So it's not going to be a terribly difficult thing to obtain. And ultimately, you're going to see a large number of drone pilots coming into the market.
Okay, so for the recreational flyer, I mean, I've got my little Hubsan with the little camera in it, right?
Yep.
Do I need to be licensed?
You do not. If you're just recreational and you've got no business purpose to your flight, and remember, it's not about whether or not you're getting paid. It's whether or not there's a commercial aspect to your flight. If you have some commercial benefit, then it's commercial. Otherwise, you're recreational. You're part of the 90% of the market that's just out there flying for fun. In those instances, you don't have any age requirement. You have to comply with what the FAA refers to as community standards. And essentially, that means you don't want to fly near manned aircraft. You don't want to fly near airports. You don't want to fly beyond line of sight. You have to be able to see your drone at all times. And you want to absolutely make sure that you are flying safe at safe altitudes. Try not to fly over people, not near stadiums, these types of things.
Now, I know that the new regs only pertain to commercial flyers. And what are we looking at there, hundreds, thousands? What would you guess?
Well, right now there are about 6,000 operators that got their Section 333 exemption from the FAA, which allowed them to fly commercially while we waited for Part 107.
Yeah.
And so you've only got, less than 10,000 operators out there who are flying nationally. Hmm. We expect that given the fact, and you had to be a manned airplane pilot in order to be the pilot in command of a drone commercially. So you can imagine that's a massive hurdle to get over, and there aren't a lot of people out there who have pilot's license who want to fly drones. Now that you're going to have this new remote pilot certificate, this new drone pilot license, and it's going to be inexpensive and relatively easy to get, you're going to go from a couple thousand drone operators to tens of thousands of drone pilots, and they're going to be able to go out, buy a drone, get their drone pilot license, and start offering their services to the customers that are looking for drone operators.
Now, I know you're an attorney and not a business consultant, but do you think there are going to evolve drone companies that will offer their services, like to real estate agents and people like that, municipalities that want to, you know, check land use regulations, that kind of thing? Do you think that's the way it's going to go, or do you think people are going to just, you know, do this themselves, or you know, have someone on their staff do it?
Matt, it's a great question. And the answer is that by and large, companies are going to hire drone operators to do their drone operations because there are still a lot of regulations that apply under Part 107. You have to stay within line of sight unless you get special permission from the FAA. You have to make sure that your daytime operations only. You have to know what airspace that you're flying in and comply with the requirements of that airspace. In Class G airspace, which is the most rural airspace away from airports, you don't need to get permission from the tower. In all other airspace, there will be some form of permission that you have to get from the tower. Hmm. Because of these types of requirements, most people aren't going to want to try and understand all of this, and they're not going to have aviation insurance that covers drones. But drone operators will. They'll be insured. They'll be professional. They'll know how to comply with the regulations. And they'll be able to fly safely without injuring people or property. So the biggest portion of the market, Matt, are going to be professional drone pilots, professional drone companies that offer services to customers.
Yet another job that did not exist 5 years ago. Yes. I'm
exactly.
A professional drone pilot. Okay.
Well, then these professional drones aren't exactly the, you know, the $200 one that you get at Toys R Us.
Oh, you love my $70 Hubsan, right?
Yeah, right. So these are going to be, I mean, the Phantom 4, I was just looking at that. That's around $1,400. Is that the type of equipment they're going to be flying, do you think?
For sure, although as you get up into some of the more complex operations where you're going to have LIDAR or some sort of multispectral payload on your drone, you're quickly into the tens of thousands of dollars. You know, a $30,000 drone is not unusual for a professional application.
Wow.
And so there will be that cost barrier for certain industries for certain purposes. If you just want to go and get great photographs of a house, that DJI Phantom 4 is a really nice drone.
Yeah. Now, are they going to have transponders next? I mean, if you got to report into the tower, I mean, how does the tower track all these drones out there?
Well, the FAA is working on that, but and there is no answer from the FAA as to exactly what you are going to have to report to the tower and how that is going to get into the system. But let's do it this way. Right now, under Section 333, you have to file a notice to airmen, which is a 1-800 number to Lockheed Martin where you say, here's who I am, here's where I'm flying, here's when I'm flying, and here's the altitude at which I'm going to be flying. That puts you into a database so any other pilot or ATC personnel can see that you're going to be there, right? So if a plane flies overhead and says, hey, oh my God, I just saw a drone, ATC can say, yes, there's a drone operating at 200 feet in that area for until 5 o'clock today. That is going away under Part 107. What it is going to be replaced by remains to be seen. We assume that there will be some sort of data entry so that everyone knows where everyone else is if they want to check. Now, the transponder issue is coming, but we're not there yet. They're not inexpensive, small enough, or light enough to be able to really effectively deploy across drones. A lot of that's coming from NASA, who's working with some of the largest companies in the world to develop that technology so that drones can see all other drones and drones can see all other aircraft, and the navigational systems, the electronic navigational systems, will take over as aircraft and drones get near each other and go in the right directions.
That's the same thing they're talking about with cars, with V2V and V2I, the semi-autonomy. One of the things I'm wondering, you know, this is just speculation on my part, but I wonder if this is going to take over for, like, traffic helicopters in the media and things like that.
Good point.
I mean, it would be a lot cheaper to have a $1,500 drone up there than a God knows how much per hour helicopter.
Yeah, thousands an hour.
Yeah.
Yeah, the helicopter pilots, the companies that offer helicopter services in movie and film and across a variety of other applications where you have surveying and these types of things to go on, that go on, is very expensive to get a helicopter. And obviously a drone is a fraction of the cost, and helicopters will be replaced You know, we'll replace the helicopters for most of those applications as we roll through the next couple of years.
Yeah, especially the ones with 4K cameras. They give you really pretty pictures of the ground, I'm sure. So
no question about it. And think about a single operator who's sitting in a central location who can run that drone flight and see everything that, you know, you would have on board a helicopter, where you'd have the pilot and potentially a reporter and all the equipment that goes with it.
Well, I'm thinking of all those guys that fly the military drones that already do that from thousands of miles away or from Bagram Air Force Base or wherever they might be. But that would be, you know, it seems like that would be a perfect logical thing for them to move into next, right?
Yeah, and, you know, it's a great point. A lot of the technology for UAV has come out of the military side. And obviously, the military applications tend to cost more, but they've taken some of that technology development and they've baked it into the pro-mercial, the professional, commercial, consumer drones that we're seeing on the market being offered by DJI and Unique and others.
Okay, we have just a little bit over a minute left. What's the timetable on the implementation of this, of Part 107?
Great question. The end of August is when it's supposed to, it will go through, it has to be posted in the Federal Register. You have to wait until the end of August until it can become effective. But then it has to be implemented, which means you have to be able to go to a testing center, take the test, submit the paperwork, and eventually get spit back a drone pilot license, right? How long that's going to take remains to be seen, and how long it takes the FAA to develop standards for reporting to air traffic control in airspace outside Class G remains to be seen. So we're probably talking fall before you're going to be able to hold that drone pilot certificate and be able to fly under Part 107 for most people.
All right. Enrico Schaefer, drone law expert from Traverse City. My friend, what's your website?
www.dronelaw.pro.
All right. Thanks very much, Enrico Schaefer. We're going to leave it there for now. Keep them flying, Han, for right now. This is Matt Rausch.
And Mike Brennan.
And you're listening to the M Squared TechCast, proudly part of the PodcastDetroit.com network. We'll be right back with Dale Kuypert of 360 Interactive, a terrific web marketing firm from Flint.
And Mike Brennan.
And we're back with more of the M Squared TechCast. And we have in studio, our one and only in studio guest today, Dale Kuypert, CEO of 360 Interactive. Dale, I know we have a list of questions for you, but I just want to get a little bit of background on your sort of career path and how you came to start the company. So why don't you tell us a little bit about that? I know you've been around a while.
Yeah, thanks. We have been around. I think we started in 2003.
Okay.
And I was in corporate America before that, doing marketing tech. And I lived in Fenton, and my office is in Minneapolis. And the commute
that's a long commute.
Yeah.
the commute was killing me. Yeah, and
were you working for General Mills or something, or 3M, or I'm just trying to figure out who's in Minneapolis.
Yeah, no, it was a building materials company.
Okay,
and so I just got tired of the travel, and my son was at Michigan State in CSE, Computer Science Engineering, and so we had a lot of commonality there, and decided that we'd give this thing a run, and here we are looking back, and it's been pretty good.
Yeah, 14 years later or 13 years later.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about what you folks do. What does 360 Interactive do?
Yeah, well, we're a digital marketing agency. We started out as a web design company, and probably about 7-8 years ago, we have picked up the marketing element to it. So there's still a lot of confusion over what digital marketing agencies really are.
Mm-hmm.
Just think about a typical ad agency. We do the same thing. We just do it in the online space.
So what should every business be doing as far as our online marketing goes?
Yeah. It's
probably as many different answers as there are businesses, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly right. And it's interesting that you phrase it that way, because that's typically what we hear is, what should I be doing? And one of the things that we really try to counsel people on is figure out what your goals are first. So with the speed of change with technology in the marketing sector, there's a lot of people that are hyperventilating over doing the next thing, the next technology. And what we're trying to get people to do is just kind of catch your breath a second, assess what your goals are, who your customer or customer segments are, and then formulate a plan and start to execute on that plan.
Well, I know you were talking before about a client might come to you and say, I need a new website. And then you say to them,
yeah. Well, how do you, or why do you think you need a new website?
Yeah.
And typically what we'll hear is we'll hear people say, well, this website isn't doing X, whatever it is that they want it to do, whether that's more sales, more leads, more donations, whatever the case may be. And it may not necessarily be the website. The thing that we ask next then is, how do you know if it's not the website or if it is? And that's where we get the blind stares. You know, people kind of give you that deer in headlight look. And so what we try to do is focus on what's really going on and do a gap analysis on it. So figure out, where is it that you want to be? Who do you want to be talking to? Who's your market segment that's really, really important for your business? And then do a full analysis of where you really are. And that analysis is twofold, right? So you've got the technology part of it. So is your technology up to speed? Is your website, is the architecture right? Is all of the tech working? The other part is, what does your business or organization look like online? Is it online? I mean, can people find it? Is there bad information? You know, with a lot of the social stuff that's going on, we do a lot of listening for companies that they're starting to have some really bad reputation issues. So you have to know what you look like online. And then once you get those two figured out, then creating the path to getting where you want to go is pretty easy.
So how important is it to be mobile friendly these days? I know I had to redo my website a year ago because that was a big thing from Google. And I imagine there's a lot of sites that aren't, right?
That's very true. It is wildly important from a couple different perspectives. So first, if your site is not responsive, just from a usability standpoint, people aren't going to fight to use it. So you're losing engagement, you're losing conversion opportunities. Then there's the technical aspect of it. So Google has made it very, very clear that they are going to penalize is a harsh word, but penalize. Yeah,
yeah.
They're going to give you demerits if you're not responsive, if you're not compiling quickly and effectively on a mobile device.
Why don't you explain responsive? I know it, you know it, but a lot of folks probably don't.
So. Yeah, very good point. There's essentially three different things that people are selling these days to be mobile. There's mobile friendliness, there's a mobile site, and then there's responsive design. So mobile friendliness can be interpreted a lot of different ways. The beauty to responsiveness is that you have one site, one set of code, one set of content, that's all you have to manage. The software determines the device that it's being displayed on and then formats itself appropriately to that device. So the problem with some of the things that some people do, like as recently as a couple years ago, we were all mobile friendly. So we would have sets of code that would display this website based on the current tablets or phones and the resolutions of those devices. Well, as new devices come out, new resolutions come out, that code is now not working any longer
right.
for the new products. Responsive recognizes what the device has, so you don't have to reset all the code all the time.
Yeah, I was wondering if there's a way that could be made automatic. One of the things we were also talking about before that I said was, that I thought was interesting was when we were talking about social media and how many platforms you need to be on. Mm-hmm. And you know, especially if you're chasing younger people, the elusive millennial. You know, Facebook is for old people now. You know, Twitter is doesn't have as many users as you think. You know, so what are the platforms that you're telling people they should be looking at right now, or does that really depend on their customer base? I bet it does.
Exactly right. It all depends on who their customer segment is.
Yeah.
Surprisingly, Pinterest, if you're advertising at do-it-yourself and males, Pinterest is a great platform. 2 years ago, you wouldn't have found a man on Pinterest at all.
Yeah. It was all knitters and scrapbookers. And yeah, right.
Yeah, a lot of scrap stuff. So you know, what we see is not – even in the social platform, but on all platforms, we're seeing new technologies, but we're also seeing different uses of the technologies that we have. So in social, as an example, we're seeing men on Pinterest. Snapchat is exploding right now.
Yeah, my kids are both into that. They were also into the one that was the 7-second video for a while.
Right.
I don't know when that was.
Yeah.
I don't even remember what it was called.
I don't remember the name, but...
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, and we're starting to see the platforms that were for the kids.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's starting to be adapted for business.
That's, you know, that's how it always goes.
Yeah.
Right?
Gary Vaynerchuk right now, he's an investor in Snapchat, and he is a huge proponent. One of the driving forces behind business is using Snapchat right now. But yeah, in terms of social, you really have to look at who's the segment that you're trying to capture. How do you want to capture it? Video is all the rage right now. So if you're inclined to go video and you have a younger audience, Snapchat's definitely the way to go. Facebook has come out with some announcements in the last 30 to 60 days about how they're going to really start ramping up video. Twitter with their Periscope is really starting to move in that direction.
Even Congress is using Periscope, right?
They are. So, yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, and it's Vine. That's the one with the short videos.
That's the one. That's it. Yep.
Yeah.
So
I tell people I've lost it since my kids graduated from college and moved out. I've lost my focus group. You know, because they, you know, I have a 26-year-old and a 24-year-old now, and they would when they were younger, they were the ones who would always tell me, you know, what. You know, where
what's
I shouldn't
cool,
be,
Dad.
Yeah, where I shouldn't be going, basically, because I don't really want to know what they're up to.
Yep.
So, you know.
Yep. Exactly right.
So, you know, what do you think people should start with? What is the starting point of putting together a sort of a digital marketing plan if you're in business?
Yeah, I think the first thing is the analysis part. Figure out where you're at. Don't spend more money on another technology or another platform or another website.
Or another consultant. This is coming from a consultant here. This is remarkable.
Exactly. And because here's what happens. So, like, if I come in and a guy says, hey, I need a new website. All right, here's your website. I charge him whatever we charge for a website. In 12 months, his sales haven't increased. His leads haven't increased or his donations haven't increased. I'm fired.
Yeah. You're not getting repeat business from that guy. Right?
Exactly. Yeah. So that's why it's important that we do the analysis to find out what really is the problem. And a lot of times what we'll find even is that the site's okay. Technologically, it's still good. There's traffic, and it might even be a decent quality traffic, and maybe for another time, but we can talk about the distinction between good and bad traffic. But so there could even be traffic coming to it, but there's something in the layout or the design of the site that's not getting the conversions. So then now we're talking about conversion rate optimization and how do we start to get people that are coming to the site to engage more or to take the step to become a customer or a lead.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, this is the question I'm going to ask my question, Mike. First of all, how many employees do you have now?
We have five.
Five employees? Okay. So are you looking for help in any area? I always ask if anyone's hiring or hiring freelancers even or project people, that kind of thing.
We just put on another graphic designer.
Okay.
And so we're all set right now. But, you know, I'll tell you, honestly, with the way growth is going, it may not be too long before we start looking for somebody again.
Okay.
Hey, let me ask you, for those you can talk about, who would be some of your major customers in Southeast Michigan that you could point to and people would recognize?
Well, some of the brands that we've worked up that are pretty visible are people like Gorman's Fine Furniture. Hagopian is a real good client of ours, great people. We work with a number of manufacturing companies, nonprofit organizations, so they're not as visible, but just we've got a whole host of clients that we work with. And our trading area actually goes from Flint to Detroit and then over to Chicago. And so we work both directly with direct clients, and then we also have traditional agency partners that we work with too.
And so what areas would you say are your sweet spot, I guess?
I think our sweet spot is coming up it sounds redundant, but coming up with a plan, executing it, and then the other aspect that we focus really heavily on is we have a phone call with every one of our clients that does marketing with us every 30 days to interpret the data for them. Because if not, if you go into a typical Google Analytics report,
they don't tell you much.
It's just numbers. And you know, the question that we get a lot of times is, how much traffic should I have? Well,
as much as you can get.
Right. But it depends on what that traffic's doing. All right. So we worked with a client one time where they were slaying it. They were getting about 10,000 unique visitors every month.
That's good.
Their conversion was less than 0.25%.
Ooh.
So it was all bad traffic. Mm-hmm. Now, if we take into consideration that every person that comes to your site costs money,
mm-hmm.
and this is a return on effort, right, instead of a return on investment. So return on effort says every piece of traffic is costing you something, whether it's Bill working in your in-house marketing department that's spending hours and hours and hours on your organic optimization, or if you're paying for click charges, there's a cost there. If you're driving all of that traffic and none of it is the right traffic, or it's poor quality traffic, or they get to your site and they can't figure out what you do, then that is a lot of money that's just absolutely going right out the window. And so what we do is, again, try to get them to just slow down, catch your breath a little bit, and let's figure out, is this good traffic, bad traffic? Why is it not converting?
I know we only have 2 minutes, but can you give us the Cliff Note version of what's good traffic and what's bad traffic?
Yeah, good traffic turns into a customer.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense, yes.
All right, so Dale Kuypert from 360 Interactive, what's the website?
It's the number 3, mm-hmm. the word 60interactive.com.
Okay. All right. Well, we want to thank all of our guests here today. We want to thank our pal Ken Rogers, who's retiring from Automation Alley. I guess everybody gets to retire, but we're still going to be sad to see him go. Patrick Anderson of Anderson Economic Group in Lansing. Enrico Schaefer, not Enrique.
Although I think Enrique is a lot sexier.
Yeah, Enrico Schaefer, our in-house drone law expert from Traverse City, Michigan. And last but certainly not least, to Dale Kuypert of 360 Interactive. And always, as usual, keeping the train running on time is our fabulous engineer. Dear Jessica, thanks.
She is fabulous.
Thanks, guys.
And I like the geographic dispersion. We had one from Troy, one from East Lansing, one from Traverse City, and one from Flint. So okay. I mean, we're covering the state.
Indeed, like a blanket.
There
All right.
you go.
We will talk to you next week at 3 p.m. Eastern Time live. And remember, you can get our segments anytime at all at PodcastDetroit.com. But until next time, this is Matt Rausch.
And Mike Brennan.
And you're listening to the M Squared TechCast.
Thanks for listening to M Squared TechCast, a live internet radio show offering the latest news and interviews with the people driving business, technology, and politics in Michigan. Join your hosts, Matt Rausch and Mike Brennan, next Monday at 3 p.m. If you can't listen live, audio podcasts of the show can be found at PodcastDetroit.com.
This is a previously recorded episode.